tonight on The Download. We reload this week's news with WTTW's Paris Schutz and former Chicago Reader editor Kevin Warwick and UK singer-songwriter Dan Kroll. Now, here is your host, a man who is doing the show live from a kiddie pool, Justin Kaufman.
Not quite, still in studio, but I thought about it today. I thought about seeing if I could, maybe I was going to call Greg Flam, see if it's possible to get one of these on discount. You know, a kiddie pool, fill it up, and just hang outside in the pool weather. Because everyone put theirs away, or maybe threw them out. You know, if you're done with their kiddie pool for the year, if it's temporary. Yeah, so I almost did it, but I instead watched 5 hours of Ken Burns on Vietnam and didn't go outside. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Thanks for joining us tonight. We're with you till 10 o'clock then when Preps Plus Chicago takes over and gives you all the latest in high school sports. But I will say thanks for listening. Hopefully you get a chance to be heading out of town today. I feel like it's the 4th of July weekend. And so if you look at Michigan Avenue right now, everybody is taking advantage of the unseasonable weather. I mean, there's just up and down, everybody in shorts. All the shorts already too tight. You know, it's, they already put on that extra 10, 15 pounds for the fall, winter, right? We all have. We just started pigging out about 2 weeks ago. Like, it's over, good. I better get that layer of fat around me for the long, hard winter. Oh, it's hot out. Oh, I better get those shorts back. Oh, they don't fit. They don't fit. I'll wear them anyway. That's kind of where we're at right now. Yeah, but it's amazing to see. Like I said, if you get a chance to head out of town, if you know you anticipated this hot streak and you got a chance to go back up to Michigan or Wisconsin, or if you're getting off of work and you're sitting outside enjoying a cold one, maybe, I don't know, working on a project with the garage open. I always think about people listening to WGN and Download right now with the garage door open, sawing something. It's like, you know, I got to take advantage of this weather. I need to saw something. Or working on some sort of project. Kids running around the yard. Whatever it might be. But WGN on the background, we appreciate it. Happy to ride shotgun. We got a great show lined up tonight. Dr. Suzette McKinney's going to join us. She is the executive director and CEO of the Illinois Medical District. This is a great story. She's going to be my guest tonight. We're doing Download in Chicago Business tonight because we didn't do it Tuesday because the Blackhawks were on. But the Illinois Medical District is an area. I live not too far, and it's essentially just west of the loop where Rush is at, where Cook County Hospital is at, where Stroger's at. And that area has now been designated. They've given it a name, the Illinois Medical District, and the goal is to connect it all to be a place not just for the hospitals that you can go to, you know, that area, the laboratories, but for facilities, for research, for all sort of biotech medical needs all there, and concentrate all of their work right in that area to be able to retain and recruit, to bring in economic opportunities to the city in those fields right there. It's fascinating. I did not know this was happening. Maybe it's on me, but the idea that Dr. McKinney will be here to talk about the goal, because I read a stat, and I want to ask her about it, that there's over $1 billion that are already dedicated to construction projects in the Illinois Medical District. And that's all the buildings, because it's not just building hospitals. They're going to build hotels and boutiques and set up new train lines and bus service and all sorts of stuff to modernize and make it a one-stop shop for those industries from around the world. So we'll talk about that coming up here on the Download. I'm very excited to have her on the program. She's coming up here at 7:30. 8 o'clock, we reload this week's news. So I love this segment. Paris Schutz and Kevin Warwick will be here. This is the segment where we look at what are the biggest stories of the week. Winners, losers, overreported, underreported. What story sucked you down the rabbit hole that wasn't Ken Burns Vietnam? And which story from this week will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 50, 500 years from tonight or this week? Yeah, I got sucked down the rabbit hole when it came to that. I think I've watched 6 hours now. because I watched the first four episodes because they've already had five of the Ken Burns that are on demand. Last night when we were off because Blackhawks were on, I was at home and I was scrolling to see what we miss when we're on. And there it was, the Vietnam War. And I'm like, my wife quickly was like, no. I'm like, no, I want to watch this. I want to watch this. And so when she went to bed, I stayed up to the wee hours learning all about Ho Chi Minh and the early days of French colonization. That's great. It's great stuff. And, you know, I wonder, for me, I've always been fascinated and intrigued by that war because I think that my generation, a generation, I'm 43, so 1974 is born, but my dad was in the Army. So many people on our block were in the Army, served in Vietnam. You get to this point where it just became part of, and just growing up in that time, I mean, the movies and everything that came out, that you just were so close to it that you almost didn't want to talk about it. And that's what this documentary is really. And there's some Marines and some servicemen who talk in the documentary about how this was a war that to this day America doesn't want to talk about. And to get the whole story, I know a lot of this stuff. And we had the book Hue during the Printers Row Book Fair, and I loved that. That was one of my favorite books of the year, Hue. And I just wonder, like, if you're 21 years old or 22 or 25 and, you know, you've 9/11 or the war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq, perhaps, might be history to you, what Vietnam means. And that's what it really is, truly a remarkable feat, Ken Burns, to put this together, at least what I've watched so far, and to be able to talk about the political side, what's happening at home, the war, and to think that there's so many of us in Chicago and around the world that were affected, that were personally affected, family members, people who are listening right now who served, who were in Vietnam, and so many stories that yet need to be told. That's the one thing I take out of it by looking at it. I was like, we need to get to a certain point where people can tell the stories of their service and what happened, you know, in that war. It's really good. I recommend it. And if so, anyway, that's where I've been for the last, if you've been looking for me, 6 hours of my life so far. And I think it's like 15 hours or something like that. So I feel like there's still a lot to go. Anyway, Paris and Kevin will be here. I'm sure I'll ask them about it throughout the hour. I feel like I'm obsessed with it, you know? And coming up a little bit later, Dan Kroll's going to join us. The UK singer-songwriter from Liverpool is a indie rock darling right now. His album, Emerging Adulthood, is hot. It's on the alternative playlist on iTunes, which is what our generation's Q101 or WXRT was. Now they don't even go to radio. They just, if they get in the playlists on iTunes or Spotify, whatever is being curated by those companies, they're in. That's like getting heavy rotation. It's so true. I mean, that's where I go. I go to Apple streaming, and I'm like, oh, let me go to the playlist. And I'll be like, Apple's selections for alternative, for indie rock, for hip hop. Oh, let's see what they're playing. So you get in there, you're in the money. Not the money, but that's a phrase. There's no money that artists are privy to. All right, news, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Roger Badish. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, let's do this. So let's do the carryout after we take a break. Stay with us. All right, so Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Why don't we do let's do the carryout, which, of course, is the nightly segment in which I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are tonight's top stories. Ooh, Senator Johnny McCain strikes again. The Arizona senator said today that he is a no vote on the latest attempt to appeal the Affordable Care Act. This is a huge blow for the Republicans, who need 51 votes by early October to get this particular bill passed. I don't think McCain will be the only one. It's not very popular, and all of the bills that have been floated, this one is predicted to kick the most people off of insurance. It also essentially gets the feds out of the healthcare biz by just making states do it instead. And yeah, I'm not sure the state of Illinois is the best governing body to make decisions on healthcare. I mean, they don't even know. I mean, do they go laces? Do they go Velcro? I mean, do they go peanut butter or jelly, right? Flat tax, sliding tax. I mean, all the basics they can't figure out. But the Senate, if the Senate can't turn any other votes, this will end the 2017 attempts to replace and repeal, which means that in pursuit of this big victory, lawmakers did nothing to deal with a broken system that's on its way to being more broken-y. It really, that's the one thing about, the one thing I will say about John McCain is he says no, not because he ideologically opposes what's in it. He says no because he believes that an issue this big needs to be bipartisan. He's the one lawmaker on both sides that has actually said, enough of this, we are in power, let's shove it down your throat. Democrats did it, which it was very controversial. Republicans have done it, very controversial. He's one of the lawmakers who stands up and says, we're not doing it anymore. I'm not going to play party to that. But at the end of the day, here comes this fall. At the end of this year, you're going to see premiums go up and Obamacare be a disaster. And the question will be, will the politicians and the two political parties try to find some political advantage in letting that happen? Or will they come together and try to fix it? And that's when the rubber meets the road. And this has been one more thing with Justin Kaufman. What else is in the news? I haven't checked my Twitter in a while. Oh, nice. The U.S. president and North Korean leader in a Twitter flame war. Always nice to see. This is what we all expected social media to be, right? When we signed up for it. Actually, Kim Jong-un still likes the old, quote, personal statement, but it's amazing to watch two headstrong leaders with massive nuclear weapons call each other madmen and dotards, which I learned today means something different than I thought. I mean, say what you will about the Cold War or even Vietnam. At least they were cordial. London is kicking Uber out of town. Yep, they're not renewing their business license for next year. Wow. To be fair, though, have you ever been in a London cab? So charming. Have you ever been in a British Mini Cooper? Nah, not so much. I'd take one of those London cabs. Former Bear Brandon Marshall put his $5 million Michigan Avenue condo on the market. I guess he's not coming back, which is a bummer. If I were him, I'd keep it. I'd fly in. I'd get a cool place to stay while you check out the Art Institute or maybe Lollapalooza, maybe some ice skating Millennium Park. Sure. I mean, the mortgage is probably $50,000 a month. But, isn't it worth it? Go ice skating at Millennium Park. I mean, maybe get some Garrett's popcorn. It's a famous condo. Former Montgomery Ward something or other. So that's cool. Check out the pics online. Pretty awesome. Although, does it have a working screen door to the patio? Because mine does. Fixed it myself. So, you know, when I sell my place, I'm going to have to list that. Also, working screen door that I fixed myself. You want to take pride in your work. Right. Rumors are swirling that Kylie Jenner is pregnant. Good for her, right? Am I wrong? Is that not good? I haven't yet checked social media to see what I'm supposed to think. Let me see. Hold on. Oh, I see. Okay. All right. It tells me that the 10-year anniversary special airs on Sunday. Oh. So pregnancy is one way to promote it. Sure. I would say billboards and interviews, probably a more safe route. But you know what? Hey, getting pregnant works too. Kardashians this weekend. In weather, wowzers, this 90-degree heat is actually because of the hurricane season on the East Coast. I can't tell you why, but it is. And we should expect this type of heat till midweek next week. Get the cooling centers back up and operational. Hope they didn't go the way of the mental health clinics in this town. Right now, someone's like, "Did we close that? We already mopped the floors of the cooling center. We closed it for the summer. People are going to track stuff in there. We can't clean it twice." In sports, what a game last night, huh? The Cubs continue to bring the magic, even during a season in which magic has been in short supply. Last night, they came from behind, held off the Brewers, and won the game in extras. And Wade Davis went two innings, paving the way for him to come in by the sixth inning in the playoffs. He might have to, based on the continued dismal performance by the Cubs bullpen. Just can't get anybody out. Chris Bryant went yard next to us. Javi Baez got a big RBI. I mean, the Cubs really rewarded the faithful that went to Miller Park to outnumber Brewers fans. It's my favorite thing about watching a Brewers game, especially in a close divisional race, is that they can't, there are more Cubs fans than there are Brewers fans. I don't understand why you don't buy those tickets in advance. Right now, the Brewers are beating the Cubs 3-2 early in the game, third inning. Lackey already given up three runs. The Cubs have now at least guaranteed that they will come out of this weekend series still on top in the NL Central. Yeah! The magic number to clinch the division is 6. And the one thing I love about this story is, I mean, the Tribune had a headline about this, but it's, I mean, you go way, way, way back to see a part in, of Cubs history where the Cubs could three-peat postseason available, or just being there, not winning at all, but just being there. I mean, I can't think in my lifetime, 84, then 85, they were terrible, 89, 90, they were terrible. Maybe in the Pinella days, they'd won and done a couple years in a row there, but this is pretty great. The Sox beat the Astros last night in Houston. What's up with the Sox beating up on the Astros? Just psychological from the 2005 World Series? I mean, the Sox did lose 2 of 3, but the Astros are fighting for the number one seed in the AL playoffs. You got to sweep. You got to sweep us right out of Houston, right? I mean, you have to. This weekend, the Royals are in town. 4-game set. Ronaldo Lopez tonight against former Cub Ham Jam, Jason Hamill. The Blackhawks annihilated the Red Wings yesterday at the UC, 2-0 in the preseason, which means absolutely nothing. But awesome to see the UC back in action last night with Hawks fans all over downtown. Back at it tomorrow night, Game 3 of the preseason at the United Center. The Bears are getting ready to take on the Steelers at Soldier Field this weekend. Whoo, boy, nothing like football in 90-degree weather. Welcome back, Kyle Long. He's back. Amakamura's back. Marcus Wheaton's back. But no word on Josh Sitton, who's got a rib injury. Also, linebacker Nick Kukowski's out. Although, I guess that's promising because after last week, we thought he was out for the year. So for him to show up on the injury report is just out. Nice. That means he could come back. The Steelers, all right, they're amazing. But they're also a team that loses these September games against lesser teams. They're the ultimate team that's like, when's the playoffs? I mean, we just need to be 9-7, right? They don't care. So they'll probably win 34-7. That's my – but still, it's going to be close. The only way I think the Bears win is if Glennon throws for 300 and runs for 150. Giddy up, Mike. In basketball, ESPN had a big piece about Pat Riley being open to a D-Wade reunion in Miami. I love that everybody just knows that we're buying out Wade's contract. I mean, he's still a Bull. Like, it's a foregone conclusion. And the only ones that don't know are us. It's like Gar and Pax, they just went around and told everybody, but don't tell the fans. Whatever you do, don't tell the fans. It's ridiculous, right? Just do it. Do it already. Also, here's a stat for you. Every single coach from the NBA last year is back again this year. Unprecedented. College football this weekend, the Irish play Michigan State, Northwestern, Illinois, and NIU get the week off. NIU coming off the big win against Nebraska. Also, Big Ten play starts as Iowa takes on top-ranked Penn State. Huh. Penn State. We're all good with them being back? They paid their dues, the Paterno-Sandusky thing. And so go, Nittany Lions. All right, good. I didn't know we were all on the same page. And finally tonight, a Woodstock farm has made a Mario Brothers corn maze to attract visitors this fall. I'm in. Although how many of us are going to try and climb the corn to see if there's any fancy mushrooms at the top, then take those mushrooms and then double our size? Sounds less like a video game and more like a bad trip. It can't be a bad trip. It's Woodstock. That's the carryout for September 22nd, 2017. What a hot weekend. We're celebrating with hot wings. The hotter the better. Don't you treat heat with heat? Or is that just for burns? But whatever. All right, coming up, download on Chicago Business. We'll talk with Dr. McKinney, the executive director and CEO of the Illinois Medical District. We'll talk about their plans to become a global leader in the medical field. That's coming up here on the download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
No, I heard you mention the Bears and Steelers this weekend. Yeah. I'm all excited for my Steelers to just come in and just, you know. But you made mention of the fact that the possibility of the Bears actually winning this game is real.
Yeah.
And if that happens, I'll be very upset.
Well, of course, as a Steelers fan, you can back that up, that the Steelers are the classic team that's like, oh, we lost to the Browns early in the season. But they still make the playoffs.
The team is so stacked that they flip that switch when they feel the need, like when they play the Ravens or the Browns.
Yeah, they like the Sunday night. If they're on a Monday night football game, they love it. The Sunday noon game, not so much.
I like your idea of the kiddie pool.
Yeah, right.
I could use one up here.
That'd be good. Is the AC still working up there?
No.
All right.
No, I've got a little mini fan on my desk blowing right in my face.
Well, there we go. There you go. Tribune Tower.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time.
I don't know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time.
Ooh, it's business.
Thanks, Rob. That's right. It's time for the Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. This is a segment where we talk with entrepreneurs, CEOs, and business leaders about their stories so we can better understand ours. Tonight, let's talk about the emerging business of biotech and healthcare. You don't have to go far to see that Chicago is serious about its investment in the medical field. The Illinois Medical District, just west of the Loop, takes up 500-plus acres and features four major hospitals, medical research facilities, labs, a biotech incubator, medical universities, and a slew of other healthcare-related facilities. The Illinois Medical District, or also known as the IMD, is way more than just a place to go when you're sick. No, the IMD is Chicago and Cook County's bid to be a global leader in this industry and an economic engine for Chicago, as there are over $1 billion in construction projects already in the pipeline. So what's it take to be a global leader in the medical field? Joining me tonight to talk about the future of the district, its continued success, and its challenges is Dr. Suzette McKinney. She's the CEO and Executive Director of the Illinois Medical District. Dr. McKinney, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, I was talking to Pete right at the beginning of the segment where I'm like, you know, I knew of the area, I know the hospitals, all that area, but I did not know of the city's push to make this an Illinois Medical District, to make it a district. What's it mean for the city to have an Illinois Medical District?
Well, first of all, it means that we have a special use zoning district that is specifically created and designed to be a hub for healthcare, health education, biotechnology, and technology innovation. But you mentioned that economic engine, and that's really important because our overarching mission space is to drive economic growth for the city of Chicago, the county of Cook, and the state of Illinois.
Well, I mean, that area just west of the Loop, right over there by Ashland, I mean, that has always been a spot for hospitals, Rush, Cook County, Stroger. It just wasn't a zoned district at that point?
Actually, the district was created in 1941. So it's been in existence for 75 years. But I say quite often that one of our biggest challenges has been anonymity. So one of my greater goals is to rectify that challenge and to ensure that people know who we are, not just here in Chicago and in Cook County in Illinois, but nationally and internationally as well.
We hear so much about emerging industries, and we talk a lot about the tech sector here and Merchandise Mart in 1871 and other industries that are coming up. Where do we stand when it comes to these the medical field and biotech? I mean, is this an area in which the city and the state want to invest in? And can we be global players when it comes to competing with other cities like Houston? I know they have a big biotech area, but can we be at that level?
Absolutely we can. And the answers to your questions are yes and yes. We can do this here in Chicago, and I think we have the potential to be a global leader in this area. You mentioned 1871. There's also Matter, which is located at the Merchandise Mart. It is specifically a healthcare technology incubator. But I was fortunate enough to recently travel with Mayor Emanuel and other healthcare and technology and business leaders from across the city, including some of the folks from Matter. And we traveled as part of a delegation to Israel to strengthen ties between Chicago and Israel in the areas of healthcare, technology innovation, as well as water conservation.
Now, that was a big story, and the mayor came out saying, you know, just being able to have the right technology in place when there's going to be water shortages in the future. I mean, when you talk about biotech, what can you learn from countries like Israel and other places that can help the city and help the state of Illinois?
I think there's a tremendous amount that we can learn. You know, first and foremost, I think in order for us to be global and for us to think outside of the box and think differently from the way we normally think here, we have to see what others are doing. We have to learn from them. We have to hear them. We have to listen to their ideas. And we have to, on a regular basis, share information and engage in knowledge exchange. And I have to tell you, the week that I spent in Israel, I saw the most amazing healthcare technologies that I've ever seen. I saw new companies that are doing everything from developing products to treat diseases and things that children deal with, such as ADHD and speech impediments, to predicting whether or not a woman will be able to properly breastfeed her child. I saw other healthcare technologies that help improve posture and things of that sort. So, you know, again, it's just a matter of learning from our colleagues that are in other areas.
You know, and I think about this because, you know, we invest in a lot of different emerging technologies and emerging industries in this state. Where there might be someone who says, well, you know what, should we be playing on that field? I mean, you have had a background that has been in Homeland Security, public health. And more often I think about the idea that should Chicago take a leading role when it comes to these industries, these emerging technologies, when we're talking about epidemics, we're talking about infectious diseases, we're talking about Zika, things of that nature, some of the things you just even mentioned here. Should Chicago be at the forefront leading this country into that fight, and what does it take to do that?
Absolutely, Chicago should be at the forefront. First and foremost, there's no reason why we shouldn't be at the forefront. And I think it goes without saying that Chicago holds right now an incredible amount of talent and intellectual capital when it comes to healthcare, biotechnology, and even issues around security and emerging and reemerging infectious diseases. So it's about harnessing that intellectual capital that already exists here, but sharing that information and that knowledge with our counterparts and learning from others and their intellectual capital as well to help us all be bigger and better and bolder than we've ever been before.
Dr. Suzette McKinney is the CEO and Executive Director of the Illinois Medical District, and we're talking about the district and how it grows here on the Download of Chicago Business Time. Let's do this. Let's take a break, and we'll come back. And I'd love to talk about the challenges, because I also know that to be, as I mentioned, all the great things that are in that area. You've also got four major hospitals that didn't really talk to each other in the past, and it's your job to make sure they do, to be anchors for a community and a district that's going to economically grow in the future. So we'll continue and have that conversation with Dr. McKinney here on the Download in Chicago Business. Stay with us.
It's business time.
It's Download on Chicago Business here, sponsored by Signature Bank. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Dr. Suzette McKinney. She's the CEO and Executive Director of the Illinois Medical District. She's having a great week. The ambulance company made a big splash this week. It was in cranes everywhere that they are coming to the Illinois Medical District. Like you mentioned, just the week before, you guys were in Israel doing the learning more about global trends in biotech and the medical fields. Talk about the challenges that are in front of you in the Illinois Medical District, because you talk about the economic part and billions of dollars are already committed to the projects to build and build out hotels, everything around that area. But at the end of the day, it needs to be a district where before it may have been district by name, but it was for competitive hospitals. Right?
That's
for,
right.
So how do you get private hospitals, one public, but how do you get these hospitals to talk to each other and recognize that they all win if they come together and be one?
Absolutely. Well, one of the first approaches that I've taken in this role as CEO of the medical district is to help the four hospitals understand how coming together and working more collaboratively benefits them all. So you may be doing great as an individual institution on your own. However, working together as four institutions toward goals and common goals, I would say, helps them all be better at what they do.
Do you have to show financial incentive to them? Do you have to say, hey, here's 10 years out, here's 20 years out, this is what we think you can do if we all come together?
Well, financial incentives always help. But I think another thing that helps, and certainly in my opinion has helped them come together more, is also really understanding the community that we sit in and some of the challenges that that community has seen, and helping them understand how we can all come together to make a long-lasting, sustainable, what I like to call catalytic change on the west side of Chicago. And those are factors that have been game changers in terms of helping us all come together. And, you know, I don't want to minimize the IMD's responsibility in this. You know, for a long time, we have sort of been a silent partner, and that is a lot of what has encouraged the hospitals to just sort of do their own thing. But we're not silent anymore.
Well, you can't be. I mean, if you're going to get the hospitals to come together and you're going to try to attract the best and brightest when it comes to the emerging fields we've been talking about, you not only have to build this district out to be a community, but you have to think, and you've been talking about this as well, to almost bring infrastructure to that area, more public transit, because people are going to be coming in there, more retail, more hotel opportunities. It's really almost like building its entire little city around these hospitals in a short order.
That's exactly what it is. You know, I would tell you that we have done our homework. We have done deep dive researching into some of the most successful medical and technology innovation districts across the United States. I have personally been out to the Boston, Massachusetts area and visited Kendall Square and that area around Harvard and MIT. And one of the things that we've seen that makes these districts most successful is having the amenities in place that support the businesses and the industry that you're trying to attract. So restaurants, residential, retail, public infrastructure,
right.
Transportation.
But none of that stuff is in that area. I mean, I don't belittle who's there, diminish what neighborhoods are around that area. But I mean, if you're talking specifically about that lot, that's tough.
It is tough.
To build from scratch.
Absolutely. But you know what? The energy and the momentum is there, and we are taking advantage of it. I think at this point, the community is hungry for it. Everyone wants it, not just the hospitals and the employees in those hospitals, but patients and their family members, but also students from the universities. We have the new Malcolm X College that's just across the bridge, and many of those students are coming into the medical district for internship opportunities and job opportunities. And so everyone wants it. And every single private sector firm that I've talked to, that's what they want as well.
The Cook County Hospital, the old building that still stands,
yes.
is an area, and it's a big part of the Illinois Medical District. What's the plans for that building? That's a landmark.
Absolutely.
What is the plan for a dormant building right now that so much has just been facades for TV shows and for explorers of the city to go, oh, I love this building, the facade of this. Is there plans to take that building down, change things up? Well, how do you see you using the old Cook County Hospital?
There are big plans for that building, and none of them include demolition. The Cook County has a very exciting plan for future use of that building, and currently those plans include bringing in a boutique hotel and then filling in the remainder of the facility with some residential as well as with some administrative space that will be primarily utilized by the Cook County Health and Hospital System. So we are very excited about that project, but I would tell you that's not the only project that's happening in the
district. Billions of dollars in there. All right, so one of the areas, you know, that's always important when you're trying to create an Illinois medical district is be able to have incentives or to be able to have funding from the government. In this day and age, whether it be the federal government, the state government, even the city, county government, we are seeing left and right a lot of change, whether it be
Absolutely.
Ups and downs, or we can't afford this, or we're thinking about getting rid of it altogether. How do you find certainty and the ability as a CEO, how do you sort of get past the idea that that's a very uncertain area and it changes by, you know, it changes with the winds?
Sure. Well, you know, as I said before, we're trying to create catalytic change on the west side of Chicago, not just for the medical district itself, but for all of those neighborhoods and communities that surround us. And to be quite honest with you, we don't have a plan to be solely dependent on government funding at any level of government. We truly believe that in order to create and sustain the type of economic growth that we are trying to achieve, that we have to diversify our funding mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And so our current strategy for the future growth and development of the medical district really is a private sector strategy. We are focusing on attracting private sector investment and private sector business to the medical district.
Which is not a gamble, because there's a lot of investment in that area right now. That industry, if you're going to go to find capital, biotech, healthcare,
sure.
Those are big industries that people want to invest in.
Yes, they are. And at the end of the day, we're trying to create an ecosystem. I like to say the environment that we are trying to create will ensure that the medical district is a place where people can live, work, learn, and play.
Dr. Suzette McKinney is the CEO and Executive Director of the Illinois Medical District. I'd love to have you back. I would love to talk more about this because as this continues and more projects come online, it's such a fascinating transition to a part of the city that, as you mentioned, has been anonymous in the past that looks to be anonymous no more. Dr. McKinney, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, which is ready to reload this week's news. 312-981-7200. What do you like? Your biggest stories, winners, losers, overreported, underreported. What story took you down the rabbit hole and which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 500 years from this week? In studio with me tonight, Kevin Warwick returning. I would say you're a champ, softball champion. I can put that on there. Two-time for the reader.
Yeah. The last time I saw you, we were arguing.
Yeah, we were arguing. And I was just a spectator.
Mm-hmm. So I was like, get back to the dugout.
Get back to these stands. Mm-hmm. Kevin is a former editor at the Chicago Reader, now a freelance journalist. Paris Schutz in studio. Paris, longtime host and political reporter over at WTTW for Chicago Tonight. Good to see you guys.
Hello.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Love to have you guys. All right, let's get to it, right? Let's get right to it. Let's get to the biggest stories. You know, I'll start it off. My biggest story is really about, I guess it happened tonight, the idea today that we heard that Senator John McCain was going to vote no on a possible repeal and replace a new bill. That story has popped up on all of our lists in different spots, but let's move it up to the biggest. I mean, this is an amazing story that continues to sort of define American politics, this attempt to repeal and replace and just come up short. What, Paris, what do you make of it? I mean, is this a historic day? Is this just another in sort of the muckety-muck that is Washington politics? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think that the bill is, if it's not dead, it's on life support, the Graham-Cassidy bill, although we, you know, because McCain wants to go back to regular rules of order in the Senate. This is his crusade now where you have committee hearings, you have testimony, and then you work across the aisle to craft something. And that was going on. And a lot of Republicans that I talk to off the record say they know that it's better policy to try and stabilize the marketplace instead of just try to gut the whole thing, because they've discovered it's very difficult to take an entitlement away from people. And there is no way to just repeal and replace Obamacare without kicking people off the insurance rolls and probably hiking premiums for people on pre-existing conditions. So they kind of made their bed by promising they were going to repeal this for many, many years, but never really having a policy. The question is, what is Senator Lisa Murkowski going to do in Alaska? What is Senator Rand Paul going to do? He said no because it's not libertarian enough.
Yeah, that's what I love about Rand Paul. He said no, it's not enough. Kill the whole thing.
Susan Collins from Maine is leaning no. So if they all stick to that, then the bill is dead. And it seems like the sponsors, Graham and Cassidy, are resigned to that. Although, you know, Collins and Murkowski and Rand Paul haven't definitively said what they were going to do like John McCain did.
That's the frightening thing, you know. Rand Paul is leaning no. Everyone says that, you know, he's leaning no, but it's the whole thing is just like one big reveal. There's no CBO score coming through. They're just like sneaking these things into the House, into Congress, and trying to like squeeze it through. And like John McCain, you know, I mean, it's great, and you know, I appreciate his conviction to say no. He likes the spotlight about it. I mean, there's no getting around that.
But right.
You know, I'll believe it when it's done. On Friday, when it's dead in the water, I'm just not there yet. It just keeps reviving itself.
It does, and the hard part about this is that I actually love the fact that Senator McCain wants to go back to the order, because this is what I think the American people want as well. And I'm not saying Republican or Democrat. I agree that the Affordable Care Act needs to be revamped. This is not sort of political in any way. But the idea that if you're going to fix this, do it in a way that we've done it in America for, you know, for hundreds of years now. Use the order that's been done in Congress. The idea that the Democrats changed it and went to the reconciliation.
Right.
Now the Republicans are using it. This got to stop at some point. So I do give a winner, category as well to John McCain to say, you know what, it stops here.
Mm-hmm. And certainly, I mean, he did vote against, if I'm not mistaken, or he did vote to repeal this, you know, yeah. when there were symbolic
he hates
votes.
It.
He's not a fan of Obamacare, no. but the climate we're in right now, like the big money in politics, and there was a great New York Times article about the big money behind the repeal. I mean, it's a lot of like the Koch brothers and those kinds of donors that are more free market oriented, and they hate this. They think this is a big, giant government entitlement, and so they've put massive pressure on Republicans to keep their promises, and Republicans are doing this. You heard Chuck Grassley from Iowa saying, I don't really, you know, yeah, there's a million reasons why this isn't good policy, but, you know, we have to keep our promises or else we're going to get thumped, you know, and they're kind of in a catch-22 because they are going to get – they're not – their funding is going to dry up from those big donor sources. Mm-hmm. But if they were to pass it, they probably would have set off a groundswell of opposition.
I just wonder, though. I wonder, guys, like, when it comes down to it, are we playing politics once again with healthcare? Because what's going to happen coming up here at the beginning of 2018 or the end of 2017, you're going to get a new bill that says your premiums go up, and in some cases there will be terrible increases where it's, you know, from paying $400 to paying $2,000, things like that. And one political party is going to be on the hook. Well, and the question is it the Republicans for not repeal and replace? Is the Democrats are being the ones who orchestrated and were the architects of it? That's where it's going to get, and that's where we start to find ourselves. You just hope that they would avoid a political catastrophe,
right.
But they seem to be heading right for it.
Right.
It's not rocket science to figure out what you need to do. And I think there are people on both sides of the aisle, more moderates in both parties. Now you have the Bernie Sanders wing that wants single payer, and then you have, you know,
the Rand Paul who wants it all gone. Sure.
But I mean, I think if you're a moderate, you got to get healthy people to buy health care, you know, because that's how insurance markets stabilize. You can't just have sick people buying health care because the premiums are going to skyrocket. And so you've got to find a way where you stabilize the marketplaces, and there are multiple insurers offering multiple products. And the only way to do that is to make sure that a large pool of people is purchasing this health care. So it's not that difficult to figure out.
I have a feeling it'll come up again later tonight. Kevin, before we get to the commercial break, you know, you had a big story as well. One that's we kind of get forgotten about in this week is the Trump UN speech. I mean, he went in front of the United Nations for his first big international speech and started off pretty well and then got real weird.
I was most fascinated just by kind of the authoritative language he used throughout and the rhetoric. And it's just, I've never seen any president concentrate on reading a speech as much as he did. So, I mean, if he read it in the car, I wouldn't even be surprised if that was the first time he saw it. But, like, just lines, like, from the beaches of Europe to the deserts of the Middle East. I mean, it's just so heavy-handed. And when he went for the Rocket Man and destroy North Korea stuff, you can just see Stephen Miller kind of feeding it into the back.
There was
of
a point when I was listening to it live here in WGN. I was in the car, and it was in the morning, 11 o'clock or so. And the first maybe three paragraphs, I said to myself, I'm like, I could see President Obama making the same speech.
It's too bad it was 40 minutes long.
I know, that's the problem. It's like he you know, it's all about tone and delivery, because Obama could easily say, we're in a world of amazing opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But there's peril. Like, you could see the same words in its delivery, but then it went south in the way that this was only Trump, the way Trump could deliver speech was right.
And certainly Obama's been tough in his rhetoric on North Korea. I think it came out that Sebastian Gorka and Steve Bannon had a role in writing this speech, which is crazy because they don't work for the White House anymore. They're outsiders, but they're still influencing the president. And it was red meat for his base. I mean, if the 30-35% of the country that supports President Trump, they're probably thinking it was the greatest speech that was ever given. They like that tough talk. They think that the U.S. has been too weak. But for a large segment of the country, it was also probably a pretty disturbing speech. And you're amping up the rhetoric. And Kim Jong-un is now talking about testing an H-bomb, a hydrogen bomb. I mean, it could just be a big game of chicken. And maybe it is the right tack.
Let's hope, but
you're putting a lot of lives on the line here.
Yeah.
And I have to say the other thing, too, that really kind of – if you're going to go there, if you're going to create or deliver a conservative speech, a hawkish speech like that, the nicknames and that part of Trump's personality.
He just can't pronounce the name.
Yeah, he's got to go. It's got to go. It's got to go. Yeah. You can't do that.
It's got to. I mean, yeah. Parrott's right. Absolutely playing to his base. I mean, that's exactly right. What they want to hear. Like, I mean, another line. I wrote it down. Sorry, I had to write some lines. If the righteous many do not confront the wicked few, then evil will triumph. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, this black and white binary good versus evil is something that resonates with a lot of people. And that, you know, Obama was about nuance and gray area, and a lot of people, they didn't like
that.
They like this good versus evil. And it's
true.
We've been playing that game for a long time. I've been watching the Ken Burns Vietnam thing.
Yeah, there you go. Ken Burns. right.
I'm going to bring that up a lot tonight. Parrott Shoulds, Kevin Warwick in studio. 312-981-7200. We'll come back with the winners, losers. I want to get your biggest story, which will play into winners and losers, the Illinois Attorney General's race. We'll get into that. Paris, Kevin, we're reloading this week's news. Stay with us. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're reloading the news with Paris Schutz and Kevin Warwick. We're on to winners and losers. Paris, why don't we start with you, because this was really a biggest story, but it also you had in the winner category, Senator Kwame Raoul. The Illinois Attorney General's race wide open after Lisa Madigan at the end of last week says she's not running again.
Yeah, and that was a surprise seemingly to everybody. I mean, I spoke to Kwame Raoul, who has wanted this job for many years, and he had no idea that it was happening, apparently. I put him in my winner because I think that he automatically kind of vaults to front runner status, I guess, among the political crowd, because he's a Democrat in the Illinois Senate of high stature. He's fought for criminal justice reform.
Yeah.
He's very close to Senate President John Cullerton, and so you've got that pot of money and fundraising. He might very well be the Democratic establishment candidate. Right now, the only other declared candidate is Scott Drury, who's lesser known, a former prosecutor from Highland Park. So this looks like something that Kwame Raoul would look to be in good shape for. Now, we don't, you know, there's State Rep. Elaine Nekritz, who's a good lawmaker, but I don't think she has the name recognition at this point. And 2018 figures to be a Democratic wave year at this point, although we never know. So it could favor him. And, you know, I've spoken to Republicans who they like Erica Harold very much. The Republican, she's very talented. She's very smart. She's very photogenic. She's beautiful. Again, that doesn't take away from her talent and smarts. But there were some Republicans that privately fear that she's too conservative to win statewide. She's very conservative on social issues.
Well, I put her in the winner category as well because, you know, she was kind of put up to run against Lisa Madigan. And they were sort of like, well, let's get your feet wet in politics, see what's going to happen. You're going to get trounced in this one because Lisa Madigan's one of the most popular politicians in the state. And now, I mean, think about all the Republican senators and representatives and politicians in Illinois that are making that call to Durkin and to others being like, are we sure on Erica Harrell?
Well, but the Madigan name is very unpopular. And I think polling showed that Lisa Madigan, she's probably the favorite, but she was going to have a tough go of it because the Illinois GOP, they've got all that Rauner money, and they were just going to sling that Madigan name through the mud because Mike Madigan is super unpopular, and they have been successful in associating her with her father. Yeah. So it might actually be – I think Erica Harold was prepared to really run against that Madigan name, and now she's got to think of kind of a new line of attack.
Well, I, for one, as a resident of the state of Illinois, is happy that's not going to happen. I'm so done with the slinging Madigan's name on every election that he's not in. You know, that part of it. I understand that people don't want him, and I understand all that. And it's not, again, it's not political in my views, but it's just as someone who watches elections, that idea that the Republicans like to do, just we'll run against Madigan, even though he's not running in the election. I hate that. Mm-hmm. I hate that. Just the same thing with, like, if you were running in the Attorney General and you're like, Bruce Rauner is terrible. Vote for me for Attorney General.
Yeah,
well, it's like, well, it's not.
Everything comes down to Madigan and Rauner. They're the two most unpopular politicians.
Like
and I mean, I Madigan is he's been in power for 47 years, and I think most people believe that he kind of wakes up every day thinking about how is he going to retain his majority and his power, and he puts that above policy. So that does anger a lot of people on both sides of the aisle. Liberals, you know, I think at this point, because he's a blockade against Bruce Rauner, liberals are begrudgingly accepting Mike Madigan. But, you know, he legitimately isn't very popular. And it has started, you know, now the GOP has all this money that they've thrown, and it has, I think, started to make waves in terms of kind of that name and associating that name with.
Yeah, I get it. I just anger. I don't know. I get a certain point where I'm just like,
just tired of it.
I'm just tired of that.
No, there's no positivity.
There's no positivity. And I also feel like we saw that Mike Madigan did not have a supermajority in the House.
Yeah.
He was not able to veto the things that were coming through. I mean, he had to work around it and the budget, and they were able to change things around and negotiate. My point being that it is not such a boogeyman as the Republicans make it out, because he didn't win, but he did.
Well,
because
and
they
10,
just kind of worked themselves
ten
around.
Republicans that went with him on the tax hike. So, and the other thing about Madigan, again, I mean, if you're a lawmaker and you have a bill and you want to do something really good for the people of Illinois, if you make it politically feasible for Speaker Madigan to, you know, if it's good for the Democratic majority, then he will go with it. It's not like he dictates what everybody does, but. But his game at the end of the day is maintaining that majority. Yeah. So,
Kevin, what do you think? I mean, you pay attention to the Illinois Attorney General's race, because it's one of the less political. I mean, it's always been a stepping stone race. It's one that you get to then move up higher office. But the Attorney General is making sure that people don't get screwed over or you know, a consumer interest and consumer advocates and things like that. Mm-hmm. Do you put a lot of stock in who's the Attorney General?
I mean, I'm really just learning from you guys for the most part. I know Madigan had, like, washed your hands of rerunning, but I don't know. Not necessarily my realm of thought. So
all right, so let's move on. We'll come back to that. We're gonna come back because I think that's a big story. I'm it's gonna be a great. It just makes the election better.
But the parlor game is, why did Lisa Madigan? She was a declared candidate, and then all of a sudden she decided not to. And it's I think. For no better reason than she did not want to go through that mudslinging. So like you said, all that negativity in her name. She's got little kids. Not little kids. I think they're probably teenagers at this point. But she doesn't want to deal with the mudslinging that they're going to throw at her because of that name. I think she's just had it. She's been in that job for many years. And it has not been a stepping stone to governor. Traditionally it has, but she tried to run for governor 4 years ago, and then she had to get out because her dad was still Speaker of the House.
The irony of it is that Lisa Madigan, even though with that name and they went mudsling, doesn't have a lot to mudsling against. She has had a run of clean years as both the Attorney General and her time in the state Senate. I mean, she has been the rock star for Democrats on that side for years now.
I think so, but it's also easy to get good headlines in that office. I'm not denigrating what she's accomplished, you know, with student loan fraud and you know, kind of the consumer issues. But in some sense, that's low-hanging fruit. You know, you look at political corruption. Her office hasn't really done anything on political corruption, and that's what gets a lot of people frustrated. Because I think everyone who knows Lisa Madigan knows she's very smart.
Right.
She's very dedicated to what she does, and I think that family name does kind of drag her down. I mean, if she decides to run one day when her dad is not in the picture, it might be a different story. Yeah.
Kevin, you got Hillary Clinton on the winner's side.
I don't have her on the winner's side.
What do you have?
I have her book tour on the winner's side. I mean, it's just been a week of PR for her book, What Happens.
Yeah, right.
She's run the gamut of, she did a New York Times thing where it was a three-person talk with America Ferrera, who's starting, got fame in Ugly Betty. And she did, like, Pod Save America, and she was on with Terry Gross. And, you know, I actually read a HuffPost. It's HuffPost now?
Oh,
it's
is.
Not Huffington Post,
it's
right?
It's HuffPost, yeah. HuffPo.
It's just HuffPo, yeah.
HuffPo.
Yeah, just put a po in there.
I've heard, you know, I've heard that the book, I haven't read, but that it's gotten some vitriolic sort of pushback, you know, calling it vapid, and like she's kind of blaming everyone but herself. But she has had a lot of face time, and she made, I think, like $20 million off the book or something like that. But I mean, that's a win.
I think they're not broke anymore, the Clintons.
Yeah, they're all right. It's hard to feel bad for
They're right, though. I mean, the media loves, for as much as we just get Over and over, we get the stories of Americans being angry that she's back in the news and blaming other people.
Yeah, people want her to go away.
The media, but the media goes crazy and telling her story.
Hey, the book is a runaway bestseller. And so there are lots of people that want to relitigate what exactly happened. But, you know, there's other books about her campaign, like Shattered by Jonathan Allen and someone else, Jonathan Allen from Politico. And all the thing, I think Hillary definitely has a lot of gripes with Russia, with Comey. But this other book, Shattered, kind of goes inside the campaign. And again, like 2008, it was kind of a chaotic campaign where there were different power centers and there was backstabbing and there wasn't a consistent message. And, you know, Bill Clinton was constantly angry with what other staffers were doing. And a grassroots movement with Bernie Sanders that they weren't prepared for.
And she's gone after Bernie quite a bit in these in these interviews that she's been doing. Like, I mean,
yeah, you know, the
blaming him definitely a lot more than she blames herself.
That makes me mad because Hillary Clinton and history forgets this. She was the front runner in 2008.
She was supposed to be,
and Obama came in and beat her, and she was not nice in that transition when it was obvious going to be Obama. She was playing games with numbers, not conceding when she needed to concede. So she did the same exact thing that Bernie Sanders did.
Well, and in fact, and I was at the convention. Was it 8 years ago now or 4 years ago? I can't even remember now. I wasn't at that convention. She you didn't know what she was going to do until she took the microphone at the convention.
That's what I mean. She did the same thing.
And Bernie Sanders, I was at the convention this year, he was urging his supporters to get behind Hillary Clinton. His supporters didn't want to do it. He had ginned them up throughout the primary to look at her as the establishment candidate, and she was mad that he had painted her as the crooked establishment, and she thought that he gave Donald Trump then that narrative to go with. But the supporters, he begged people to vote for Hillary Clinton at the convention because he knew, you know, if you're a liberal or progressive, you don't want Donald Trump. But it was really the grassroots Bernie supporters that were just not.
I have in the winner category, and we'll go quick because I got news, Jimmy Kimmel. I just think that his name out, and regardless if you agree with him or not or whatever it is, but the idea that he's going viral for doing monologues about healthcare is mind-boggling. And also I have the Cubs as winners as they once again find the way to take a mediocre season, but at the end they show magic and they're right back in the driver's seat. We'll see what happens tonight. Kevin Warwick, Parachutes in studio tonight. Let's take a break. We'll get tonight's news. We'll come back, and then let's talk about the losers from this week. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. All right, we've gotten through biggest stories. We did some winners. We're going to do some losers coming up here. Kevin Warwick, former editor at the Chicago Readers in studio. Paris Schutz, who's a host political reporter at WTTW Chicago Tonight. All right, so we did winners. Let's do losers. Why don't we start with Paris? You have Toni Preckwinkle.
Yeah, well, that
she's not had a great week.
No, she hasn't had a great
two months.
Yeah, a couple of months. I think the news that Mike Madigan now was going to kind of try and pull the plug on this whole Cook County soda tax is kind of the death knell here. I mean, Toni Preckwinkle is fairly independent and tough-minded, and she doesn't like to take a lot of guff from people, but it's Mike Madigan, and Preckwinkle is a loyal Democrat, so she might have to kind of eat crow on this and just get rid of this tax. It's been so – I mean, it's really the soda companies in the retail industry that's created these super PACs, and they've pumped all this money into this campaign to get rid of this tax. It is driving business down, and especially in the collar areas of Cook County, so it's hurting business. But I mean, you hear people talk about it. It's like this is the biggest civil rights issue of our day.
I know. I don't know why.
When are they going to pay an extra 50 cents on your liter of Coke?
It hurts me only in the way that I'm like, okay. Like, this shouldn't get as much coverage. I almost have it in the overreported. Right. And I feel like people go crazy and think their world is going to change for 50, 75 cents. And it is a big deal. I understand that. But the loss of business and the sticker shock, that was anticipated from anyone who thought there's going to be a tax on sodas. The idea that we're acting as if we're shocked and all that, whether it be the media or the people who buy the soda, You knew this was going to happen, and I kind of like it. I actually like, and I know people get mad at me on the show, and I get texts as well, but I like that Cook County Board President Toni Preckwinkle continues to fight for what she says she believes in. Now, most of the argument is she's lying. She doesn't want it to be. It's not about health. Well, it's about money, and she's just another politician, you know, that kind of stuff. And if you don't believe that she does, if you don't believe she believes in this, then yeah, maybe you have a problem. But if she really truly believes that obesity, diabetes, the issues that go along with the tax that you see in the commercials and all that is important for the well-being of her residents, it makes total sense to me.
Well, yeah. I think, yeah.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think that the opposite end of that, the argument is, well, if it's really about health, then why don't you tax cupcakes and why don't you tax ding-dongs
and
ho-hos and Twinkies?
That's what Boykin says, right.
But, yeah, but, you know, and the thing is, it is about revenue, and she's been upfront about that. The county needs revenue, and she said that the property tax hike was not going to be feasible, sales tax was not going to be feasible. This was a way to get $200 million a year. Now, there's all people that are upset that she kind of negotiated these union deals with raises and stuff right around this time. So there are lawmakers that are like, wait a second, are you doing everything you can to cut Cook County government and before you raise taxes? So that's where the divide is.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, it is about revenue. And if you can also impact health at the same time, then you kill two birds with one stone. But no one, I think it's wrong for people to say, oh, this is, they say it's not about revenue. Everyone knows it's about revenue.
Right.
Yeah. She said
it.
I mean, it really is such like a pervasive, I mean, you talk about the fact that soda, the reason that why everyone's so interested in such a polarizing issue is because it is soda. Like, and everyone drinks soda. It's a pervasive issue. And I mean, it's one thing with property taxes, but soda is such like a basic thing that you just get at any like corner store.
Well,
or whatever.
I'm a Cook County resident, and as somebody who because I've heard people say, "Well, why not property tax when others?" But you know what? Property tax. I live here, meaning they're gonna tax me regardless.
Yeah.
I can make the choice to not buy the six pack of Coke. Right? I can make that choice to say, you know what, I'm not going to get taxed. I'm not going to buy it. I'm going to change my habits. I didn't get taxed. I've changed. I don't think I've had a soda since all this stuff has happened because I'm like, I am a frugal Chicagoan who's like, I don't want to pay the 75 cents. I'll drink water.
Let's be perfectly honest. This is not a product that is good for,
yeah,
for you in any sense.
That is exactly what it boils down to.
Yeah.
And,
you know?
and she's
people
banked,
like it, but
she's
it's not
banking
good
on
for
that.
You.
And
yeah.
It's like, yeah, good for her. I mean,
yeah.
She knows. I mean,
although the other argument is SNAP recipients, you know, it doesn't apply to them. Legally, you can't make it apply to them. So yeah, there are some inconsistencies, and that's where they're trying to hammer her.
Yeah.
312-981-7200 if you want to check in. Kevin, you had, and we kind of touched on it already, you had Cassidy versus Kimmel.
Yeah.
In the loser category. And I could see Cassidy is really –
I mean, the last monologue that Kimmel did was, I think it was like a 10-minute long monologue where he was just, Cassidy, I think, came back at him and said, he just doesn't understand it. You know, everyone's discounting Kimmel's opinion. And so he came back, if I don't understand it, then why are like, you know, he goes through like, why is the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, the American Cancer Society, the March of Dimes? And he just goes, I mean, it's like a 2-minute long list. And he just kind of tears them apart. And Kimmel's son, the reason a lot of this is like, precipitated by the fact that Kimmel's son had open heart surgery when he was born, and he has two more, I think, to go, and so he's kind of used the healthcare bill as his platform a lot.
I think he's very articulate.
He's
great and simple in his. He always says, and I think people, it's not unlike with what we were just talking about with Preckwinkle, like people pick and choose, but he says, I can afford it. I have health insurance. I'm a celebrity. I'm a rich guy. But there are a lot of people I've met during my son's ordeal that can't without affordable health care. And that's what he's become, this spokesperson to say, guys, and he had Cassidy on his show right after the last one.
Yeah,
and he got
promises
right,
yeah,
saying there will no – and now those promises are you know, the way that's answered – the way it's answered from a lot of lawmakers is, well, it's up to the states, but, you know, it'll be all right.
It's all the pre-existing conditions too, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's up to the – but the way it's structured is that it would be – I mean, the premiums would go way up, like by thousands exponentially for people with pre-existing conditions. But, yeah, I mean, and Jimmy Kimmel brought up the point where he's like, you know, Donald Trump didn't actually – President Trump didn't read this bill, and it does seem like Kimmel did take the time to really do his homework on it, and there were a lot of you know, lawmakers that didn't really know the substance of it. And we don't know. I mean, you know, President Trump is not into, you know, the specifics and the nuts and bolts of policy. So he could be right. I mean, President Trump might not really have any concept of.
Well, you know, there's been so many experts who or people in the news and pundits who've come out and said, you know, Jimmy Kimmel, leave the policy to the healthcare experts. And rightfully so. So many people shoot back saying, the healthcare experts are the people in Congress.
Yeah, well, I mean, he said, okay, the AMA and the physicians
those people
groups
are different. Right?
Well, they all were concerned about it. So those are quote unquote the experts, I would think.
Yeah. So tired of the leave, like stay out of
right?
Well, yeah, I mean, and if you watch Fox News, you know, they're
not staying out of it. Right.
Well, they have like, you know, Ted Nugent and Scott Baio, and so it's like that's disingenuous for. For them to when it's something they don't agree with, sit down, just
do
comedy.
They're washed up, though. That's the that's the difference.
Well, it's the same when athletes. I love athletes speaking out for what they believe in,
whatever it
is.
I agree.
Use your platform. This is just the beauty of this country, is to use your platform to be passionate about something.
I agree.
What I have for losers is Uber. Losing in London, the city of London revoking their business license. So next year, Uber will not be welcome in the city for all sorts of reasons. But also a study I saw where in Chicago, cab rides are, 50% down or half down?
Oh, yeah, 40, I think, something
40%.
Like that. Yeah, yeah.
And it begs the question about, you know, what's being done to when we talk about Uber and we talk about Lyft and we talk about ride shares and we talk about cabs and that continuing competition in the city of Chicago. I don't know where we're at. And at a head scratch when there was some, remember there was the lobbying about, there was some aldermen that came out and said there needs to be more regulation. We'll put a dollar on every Uber and Lyft. And then there was the lobbying effort that came out, said that ain't going to happen. And then the cabs have been sitting here with a gas tax, 50 cents. Yeah. At the end of the day, the consumer, I mean, this is black and white, right? I mean, the idea is that it's cheaper to get in a Lyft than it is to get in a cab, and that's the problem.
It is. It's cheaper. It's more convenient, and you can just have them come up to your door in 5 minutes anywhere in the city. But it is unfair that the city regulates the price of taxis
that's the problem.
So they what they should do to level the playing field is just not regulate the price of and have taxi drivers do the same thing that Uber. I still don't understand.
Driving Uber too. Like they have to. They're being their hand is being forced to cross over to drive Uber and Lyft.
I find that I you're right on both. I mean, that's it. I mean, the regulation has really handcuffed the taxi industry to compete in a fair market, and that may be because they were a monopoly for a long time and it was cabs and cabs only, but it's not anymore. And I know it's a big piece of revenue for everybody involved who's putting their hands in the cab or the taxi industry's money, but at a certain point there needs to be a thought that the regulation is killing an industry.
I mean, level the playing field and let's see who wins. I mean, that's a free market, but right now it's not a free market because the taxis have these regulations on them that Uber and Lyft don't. So yeah, the city could pass an ordinance that says we're not going to regulate cab fares. Although, then that lead, you know, Washington, D.C., I remember I was there years ago, and they didn't regulate cab fares, and they had certain cab companies charge you like an arm and a leg at like midnight, you know, when everyone's looking for a cab. Mm. Then it just gets out of control. So that's why fares are regulated. So they have to find some solution.
How's that different than surge pricing?
It isn't.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I actually take cabs more than I take Uber and Lyft. I find there is more traffic in the city because of Uber and Lyft. I find there are more reckless drivers. I almost got hit on my bike on the way over here by an Uber.
It is surprising. Being down on Michigan Avenue, which used to be all cabs, especially at night when you pull out of here at midnight, it's now all Uber and Lyft.
Every other car on the road is Uber and Lyft.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So it's an interesting – I just like to see more – maybe it's a better lobby. Maybe it's more advocates in city council or downstate to say, hey, let's fix this issue because it's not fair to the taxi industry that they're getting bounced out because of
– And everyone's argument is, well, you had a monopoly for so long. Yeah. It's like –
the rideshare industry is lobbied to the hilt. I mean, they have totally connected, you know, former political people that are doing their lobbying. And so they've spent a ton of money in every city to make sure that they get into the airports where they used to be banned from the airports, or they get to Navy Pier. I mean, they've gotten a very impressive lobbying organization up and running.
They'll always push it through. It always happens.
Kevin Warwick, Perrick Schutz. All right, so we'll do overreported, underreported coming up here as we reload this week's news. Stay with us. It's the download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Kevin and I just trash talking softball. And the
it's all I got.
That's all I got.
I'm milking it for as long as I can.
Kevin Warwick, former editor at The Reader. Paris Schutz, political reporter and host at Chicago Tonight on WTTW. We're reloading this week's news. Let's do overreported. All right, I'll start. Sean Spicer at the Emmys.
I don't care. What
like,
do you do?
Became thought pieces. They made a bit where he came out and he made a joke about the size of the Emmys. The crowd.
I did hear that Colbert was like humming along, and then when he brought Spicer out, it was like
he messed it up.
It was a mess up. Yeah,
it was a shocker. But the thought pieces that came out afterwards, like he can't have a voice, he's a liar, and he's a part of the Trump administration. We can't validate it. We can't. I was just like, all right.
Yeah, this plays into the whole culture wars too. I mean, the fact that the Emmys were so political, and then so quote unquote flyover countries, like damn Hollywood, you and you liberals out there, you know, it's just the same old garbage. I thought it was interesting that no network would hire him as a commentator because they don't find him credible.
Toxic, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, and a lot of these people, they take these jobs because they think it's going to lead to lucrative careers after, and this, you know, seems like it's not the case for Sean Spicer, which probably is not what he had in mind.
Well, I just thought that the there was so much on Facebook and Twitter and actors speaking out and others saying that, you know, he shouldn't have been there. We should not legitimize the lies from this organization or this administration. I didn't think he did anything except make a joke about himself, and it was perfectly timed. It was a good joke.
And yeah, you would know.
It was a good joke.
Too touchy then, right?
Everyone was too touchy. I thought it was funny, and he moved on, and he was a prop for Stephen Colbert. He made a joke. He said, we don't know how big the crowd is watching tonight, but I know somebody does. Sean Spicer. He's like, the biggest crowd ever. Coming up next, something else. And I'm like, he's a prop.
That's pretty funny. Yeah.
It is funny. Yeah. And I just felt like I understand the idea that this pushback, Jimmy Fallon messing with Trump's hair or putting these guys on. But you know what? Come on.
Yeah,
get off.
At some point, people just have to decide what's legitimately offensive and what are you just trying to score points with saying that's offensive and that's, you know, I don't know.
I don't know either. I just
I try not to pay attention to that.
All right. Well, you have for overreported something you don't want to pay attention anymore.
Yeah,
Amazon.
Every day this week the mayor is getting all this publicity on Amazon. The mayor and governor are working together and they're sending a team to Seattle. I mean, we don't know what Amazon's going to do, and they're not going to make a decision till next year. But you know, right now the mayor gets to have this image of being the hard charging, guy that's going to recruit Amazon to Chicago.
That was last week's the same one. It was overreported last week.
Wake me when something happens.
It's great headline because it looks like they're working to bring business.
Right, but wake
is
me
it a
when
good
something.
Thing? I mean, whatever. I mean, that like, yeah, wake you when
great,
something.
Great question.
Well,
is it a good
you know,
thing? I don't
or wake me when we know what the incentive package is going to be. I mean, you mean the state is going to give them tax incentives, and the cities? They're probably going to wind up being tax free. Amazon, they're going to have a tax free corporate headquarters. Probably that's how bad these cities are vying for this, and it is 50,000 jobs. Apparently that's pretty good. You want to get that. I mean, that's a good feather in your cap, even for a city like Chicago. Yeah. So, I think
you're right. It's not going to a decision.
It's
not,
they're not going to make a decision until and I do think the state of Illinois in the financial situation with the pensions and the backlog of bills. If you're Jeff Bezos, you can't not be concerned about that.
It's like, coming here. It's just not going to happen. I don't know.
You think LA?
It's going to Portland or like
Charlie Meyerson had a great point last week. He said this is
Charlie on.
Charlie was great. You know what he said? He said that they need to be in a spot where weather won't destroy them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that the city doesn't shut down. So you can't be on a coast where a hurricane or New York or anything. You can't be in LA where earthquakes and things. In Chicago, the biggest thing is a snowstorm, and Chicago has proven time and time again doesn't shut down.
Yeah, this is one of the safest, weather-wise.
A tornado could wipe it out. But
but the tornado, Michigan is moderating. Tornadoes never make it into the city limits of Chicago. It's always out in Plainfield. Right. I mean, it's not good that it's out there, but they never get further east.
So you can understand that could be a selling point, not beyond all the other things you could sell to convince a place that needs to be operational, even in the worst weather, to come here. Anyway, all right, moving on. Overreported, you have the Stranger Things bar and Netflix, which I totally agree. Who cares?
Yeah, I mean, number one, it's a pop-up bar anyway. And
so pop-up bar in Logan Square. That
yeah,
did a,
all of Milwaukee
things.
Avenue is just going to be a big pop-up in like 6 years anyway. So, but like, so yeah, it's just, it's run by a couple guys. And I think the last date was the end of September anyway. So they got a letter, like kind of a cheeky letter from Netflix about, you know, and it played to the theme. It's like, you guys are great, but like, don't go past the 6 weeks pop-up. Because the Saved by the Bell one kept getting like rebooted a bunch. Mm-hmm. You know,
and then just Mr. Like, Belding like actually showed up,
yeah,
I think,
yeah,
one
yeah.
night
yeah.
as a promo.
I mean, I'm tired of Stranger Things anyway. Like, I was tired before the pop-up bar.
But the amount of press it's gotten for
yeah,
the fact
know,
that a cease and desist off of Netflix, which isn't really true, because they're still up and running right now.
Yeah, I think they're just
yeah.
I think
they're just
like
running out the
through.
String.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone's like, oh, it was so classy of Netflix, because it did play to like the themes of Stranger Things and the language and
yeah.
stuff, and Whatever.
Kevin Warwick, Paris Schutz in studio. When we come back, we'll get an update on tonight's news with Rob. When we come back, let's do underreported, a much better category, and then we'll talk about which stories took us down the rabbit hole and which story's going to be remembered from this week. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio with me tonight. Paris Schutz, he's the political reporter and host over at WTTW Chicago Tonight. Kevin Warwick, former editor over at the Chicago Reader, freelance journalist now. All right, let's get to underreported. Paris, I like yours. I mean, you've got the Hyperloop proposal.
Oh, yeah. I think that's good. That Elon Musk,
yeah.
I mean, you just get into a pod and it's... It's like, I guess
stop
it's...
Stop right there. You've struck gold.
You get into a pod and you just get transported warp speed to another place. You can get to Columbus in like a half hour or an hour, and Pittsburgh like an hour or an hour and a half. And
it would be so great.
If they,
it?
Yeah, I mean, if they can make this financially feasible, this is going to be an amazing mode of transportation. And they say the technology is there. They just have to make sure that you don't like incinerate yourself if something
yeah.
goes wrong.
And
then
it doesn't
you're going
cost,
600 miles an
right.
hour.
And it know? Doesn't cost $2,500 to use.
Yeah,
I mean, they can't. The technology is there, but they can't even figure out how to get to the airport from downtown. I mean, they've been working
well,
on this
and,
for a long time.
And I think Emmanuel is interested and has talked to Elon Musk about this as a way to get to the airport. And it will be very expensive, I think, if they do it. But, I mean, if they do make this economical and put it everywhere, who would want to fly again?
Right.
You know, I mean, you just get into a pod and boom, you're there. It's Star Trek stuff.
And
it's
I think
great.
And I think it's great. I also think the O'Hare, going back to the idea of using that same technology for O'Hare, what a great concept.
Yeah.
If they can get that to go where it only takes 10 minutes, 15 minutes to get downtown for when after you get off your flight, that would be amazing.
Seems,
that's the biggest problem with airports.
It seems pie in the sky. I mean, they probably do it in a couple of minutes. I mean, that's how fast it can go. But it's pie in the sky right now. But so what? Dream big. You know, this is...
Make no small plans.
You know, let's see where it goes. Right. Let's see if the technology becomes financially feasible.
I've got two stories for underreported. I have the Wheaton College hazing story,
yeah.
which, I didn't recognize. I saw it, and I was like, another hazing story, didn't care. And then I didn't realize that it had Muslim overtures in the way that one of the students was Muslim, and it could be a hate crime. But then the other story that I didn't realize is that this happened a while back.
Mm-hmm. And the school had supposedly done its own investigation.
And they
and
said nothing.
It.
They closed it.
Yeah.
No, there were no suspensions.
Yeah.
There were no reprimands. There were nothing. And but when you get to the details of this hazing, where it's way beyond sort of, we got you in the middle of the night and we took you out to the field. I mean, they're broken bones and
right.
shoulders are out of whack and people, I mean, just really nasty stuff. The idea that the school just kind of looked the other way with all everything that worked there, this story is only going to get bigger. I mean, as more
yeah.
comes out, you're like, yeah.
It also just makes you wonder how often this stuff happens and is swept under the rug constantly
right.
or the cases are closed.
And this is a Division III school where supposedly, you know, sports are an afterthought,
right.
you know?
That's
no one's
point.
There on scholarship.
So you would
and
assume that the,
you'd assume
the
that, that,
campus management would be like, would yo,
do
you can't
something.
Do this.
I mean,
yeah.
okay, I had it at Florida State and Tennessee or Texas A&M. Not that it's, you know, permissible anywhere, but you, like that's where football rules. You know, those schools are all about football. And now this is Wheaton College, a Christian college where football is supposed to be an afterthought. That's really weird.
Yeah.
The other story I had was the Puerto Rico hurricane, Hurricane Maria. The I feel like we're hitting a little bit of hurricane fatigue, mm-hmm. and that's a bad thing, and that's why I think it's underreported. I think it's still being reported. I think that you'll see in the New York Times and other places great reporting on what's happening in Puerto Rico, but I think that for all of us, the consciousness has been like, another hurricane, like the destruction. Maybe hopefully it'll be okay. But in Puerto Rico, this storm, I mean, it was a direct hit. It turned 4 to 6 weeks, yeah. 4 to 6 months without power. That's what they're looking
at. That's unfathomable.
Yeah.
To think about, I mean, San Juan, these big cities, as big as Chicago. Like, no power for 6 months.
I know. I mean, go ahead. Well, Paris and I were talking during the break just about the fact that the Mexico City earthquake happened, and I think you said that reporters from here were sent down there.
Yeah, they're the reporters, Chicago local reporters sent down there because... Probably because you can still get into Mexico and it's a very cheap flight and there's it's a and good visual story of
this
people
is
rescuing
also
people.
The second largest Mexican population besides Mexico City
Rican population here isn't as big although there is a population
big,
I think it's the third
hurricane and we went through Irma and we
and
went
like
Maria.
pop too it was like it's not like there was
I just I apart. Think it's a big it's a huge story I mean it's a U.S. territory I it's great to see. I saw that Daddy Yankee was doing a big concert for the guy who was on the Despacito track. That's the song of the summer. Mm-hmm. You saw, I think one of the Cubs that it was one of the Cubs is from Puerto Rico.
Javi Baez.
Was doing was they were talking to him. But I just I mean you look at what happened and you see some of the video and the pictures there. This is not we got spared. Hopefully it'll be back. I mean this is devastation. There's just water running everywhere.
A dam bursting. This is a poor. It's U.S. territory. It's a poor place. It's houses that were built that probably couldn't withstand this at all. And it's you're right. I mean, you've heard more about the Mexico earthquake, which is also a horrible tragedy. Yeah. But there's something to what you're saying. It's like another hurricane. We already did that story.
Yeah.
Right.
A caller told me this was on Friday. Texted me and said, all this stuff happened after the eclipse. As they said, like the hurricanes and the earthquake.
There you go.
So yeah, we all got excited with our sunglasses or our glasses, and now we didn't realize that the whole world has changed weather-wise. Mm-hmm. Kevin, you got one about Donald Trump. An interesting story about how he does not laugh.
Oh yeah, it was an opinion piece by David Litt and the Sunday Times titled "Is Nothing Funny, Mr. President." He kind of piggybacks off the UN speech and just. How stern it is, and he kind of goes through some, examples as to he just never laughs. You've never seen him laugh in any speech, like just to break the ice for a joke, just to be folksy for a second. It just doesn't happen. Paris said earlier that it has something to do with he just doesn't have that. His agenda is the kind of like fire and brimstone, doom and gloom. Everything's terrible. We need to get back to the past. So. There's just no lightness to him.
I mean, it just seems like that's always on his mind from when he wakes up to when he goes to bed. That is his obsession all day. And he doesn't seem like someone that actually sits back and smells the roses and genuinely. I think Chuck Todd had said once that he had never seen Donald Trump actually laugh. I mean, you'll see him smile or give a forced smile when he's glad handing, but never. Like a hearty guffaw or laugh.
Well, it's funny too, and as someone who's done comedy in my life, he is a straight man. He likes to, and I wouldn't even say straight man. No, he delivers jokes. Mm-hmm. When you see him with the nicknames and then the rallies, or even on Twitter with the memes, he likes to deliver jokes. His style is deliver it in almost a deadpan kind of, or even like a very kind of
abrasive
way. But you're right, he doesn't laugh along. Mm-hmm. He's a guy who delivers it, laugh at the joke I just told you, move on. That's a certain style. There's comics that do that. But there's a lot also like will laugh with it. I mean, if you watch Chris Rock's a great example of a guy who will laugh with it when he tells a joke, things like that. But Donald Trump's not a comic. But
Right. I mean, if you're gonna do a 40-minute State of the Union address or whatever, it's just nice to have like a little light moment in there, here or there. Not, it's like they're usually hokey jokes and not good. But.
I wonder if he'll evolve. I wonder if as he now gets a chance to do more presidential stuff, that he goes, nah, now let me get a second shot at the State of the
Union.
He'll
retweet more memes from people who have had racist tweets in the past.
Yeah, Or less. Hopefully less. Kevin Warwick, Vera Schutz. All right, we come back. Let's find the stories that took us down the rabbit hole and which stories will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 500 years from this week. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download Here as we wrap up and reload this week's news. Let me go to the text. We had a lot of text coming in here today. Let's go to Mary. Mary's got most underreported story was the homeless living under the viaducts in Uptown. Oh, yeah. We didn't even talk about that story.
Right. That's a great, great one, Mary.
Yeah, she says the Uptown neighborhood moves so that the let's see who she says here all the way through. Construction can begin. I think it's so vital that the city really put an effort into creating affordable housing, especially for homeless people. I've heard many homeless people interviewed say that they had a if they had a secure place to live, sleep, eat, and wash, they could do much more. If Puerto Rico is so underreported, how come you know so much about the conditions there? That's what Sue said. Come on.
It's being reported. Somewhere,
as I said, it's more about the consciousness that
we're not talking about it as much. I think
847 says Twinkies are not good for you. White bread's not good for you. A bag of Fritos is not good for you. The Cook County soda tax makes no sense, and it's not good for anyone. 630 says the tax is a revenue issue, nothing to do with health. Most of the time, parents are purchasing, not kids. Please understand, this is the nanny state, 1,000%. There's some stuff about King Obama.
Who's King Obama? We live in the kingdom of
Obama. All right, let's get to the stuff that took us down the rabbit hole, and then we'll get to the stories that remember in 5, 10, 15, 500 years. All right, so why don't we start with you, Kevin? You said the announcement that Jesus Lizard's coming back. I love
it. Are you familiar with Jesus Lizard?
I am. Yeah.
So 8, 9 years ago now, right when I moved to Chicago, they reunited and played Pitchfork.
They're a Chicago band, right?
Yeah. They're noise rock legends. They're one of my favorite bands. And it got announced this week that they're going to play their first show in 8 years at a festival in Houston. And we can only hope that is a preface to a longer tour. So last time I saw them, I saw Metro, David Yao jumped into the crowd and broke his rib. And then the next night, I saw them, and he was sitting on a stool for a little while because he had a broken rib, and then he jumped in the crowd anyway. Because he's a 50-year-old madman, so I'm very excited for that.
It's so great when your favorite bands get back together.
Yeah, I will never tire of Jesus Lizard reunions. They can do it forever.
They can do it forever. Paris, you had a great pop culture story.
Oh, yeah, this is a tragedy here.
I wish we had the theme song.
That theme song's amazing.
It was good. Yeah. The Family Matters house being torn down.
The Family Matters house. Yeah. I mean, who didn't grow up on Family Matters? And the house 15-something West Wrightwood, I think. The house of the Winslows and Steve Urkel coming over and giving Carl, you know, a headache every episode.
Right.
And
Family Matters, it was set in Chicago.
Set in Chicago,
they had the facade of the house.
The facade of the house was Lincoln Park.
I learned two things.
They're going to tear it down.
That it was in Lincoln Park.
Yeah.
And that it was actually set, they were supposed to live in the suburbs. They were supposed to have,
right.
be a suburban family.
Yeah, I know. Which is weird. No, I always knew. I mean, in the opening credits, it shows where the house is and you can see, like, the lakefront. And I don't know.
What's really interesting is that Full House.
It's good. They're going to turn it into condos.
Yeah,
they're going to tear it down.
But the Full House, if you go to San Francisco, there is a industry around
Full House.
Seeing the house that Full House.
And this is just some house that probably like three ex-college kids like live in, you know.
And I couldn't take it out of a lineup, I guess.
Former college roommates at Michigan State moved in here, you know. Yeah, I know. It's so Chicago. It's just a regular house.
It really is,
But yeah, it made me go down the rabbit hole of watching all my favorite episodes, like the one when Urkel came
Did
in.
Did you watch episodes?
Well, I watched like some YouTube clips. I loved it. I loved
God
it.
Help you.
When Urkel, Carl Winslow and Urkel, that dynamic is comedy gold. Carl was always frustrated and always turning red, and Urkel was always getting under his skin on something, and I don't know. I mean, it was a formulaic comedy, but it was... You know,
it was our formulaic comedy.
Right. So that's they're going to tear that down, and it's I guess another sign of gentrification, and they're going to build some sterile looking condo there.
Yeah,
I guess.
But in 15 years, that sterile looking condo will be a facade for a different show that's shot in L.A. that's set in Chicago.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
There we go. Exactly.
Mine was I watched 6 hours of Ken Burns, the Vietnam War in the last day. Yeah, I'm a little burnt out
today.
Yeah, I watched 4 today and then 2 last night. Like, wow. I really got into it. But I have to say, that is unbelievable. Ken Burns has outdone himself. I mean, to know a lot about that history and then to have him tell the story of even the French colonization all the way up to...
Right, to go way back into the...
And the footage is there and the interviews. It's so good.
He does both sides, too, right?
Lynn Novick is the other filmmaker, and she went to Vietnam to interview former North Vietnamese and Viet Cong. It's 18 hours, the whole thing. I mean, it's like... The guy doesn't believe in editing very much. He's a genius, and they're both geniuses. But man, they really put a. I mean, if we're not experts on Vietnam by the end of this, we're not paying attention.
It's exhausting to watch, but you can't stop watching.
Yeah, but it's good though because in a way, it's a film record of our history. Yeah. You know, it's like we have textbooks. We have, and he wants to be the filmmaker of record of United States history, and from veterans that I've talked to, I mean, they say this is a very balanced interpretation of what happened.
I have to say,
you know?
the two storylines that I pulled out of it that I did not know, and this is my naivete, not being from that generation. One, that Ho Chi Minh and the North Vietnamese, they didn't start out being communists. They wanted the United States
to
come
friends,
in.
They were friends of the United States. Yeah, that was fascinating.
They chose communism because China was like, we'll give you guns.
Ho Chi Minh fought on the side of the Allies in World War II, and he thought the United States was aligned with him against the French. He thought the United States was going to help them
get rid of colonialism. War, right.
Yeah, and but he did become infatuated, according to that movie, with was it Lenin?
Yeah. The Russian,
Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So he kind of went,
that was after the United States kind of turned him down.
Yeah.
When the United States was supposed to help with France and they didn't really help and they kind of like left it there, he had no other choice
but to find another endorsement. The French convinced him that this was going to be a proxy for Russia in the Cold War and that they had to side with Western power. But then South Vietnam, you know, horrible puppet government they had there. Yeah.
My last thing, and then we got to get to move on, is that then it's a great way the last episode ended where a Marine said,
"Oh, you're ruining the ending for me. I haven't gotten there yet."
Oh, you haven't gotten there? No, I'll save it.
No, go for it. All it was about is that
the U.S. government knew that they weren't going to win that war.
Oh, yeah.
Way, way, way before
Kennedy.
They actually escalated.
Kennedy said something to the effect of, I know that this is unwinnable, but I can't get reelected if I just pull out of a communist country and I let the communists declare victory or whatever, so we'll get reelected and then we'll figure out. I mean, a lot of people think Kennedy would have pulled out if he were to live.
Right. All right, Warwick. What story is going to be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 50, 500 years from this week?
Christopher Borelli's Trashed and Abused, What's Left After a Music Festival Ends story that came out after Riot Fest. There was just several things that I didn't know about. I didn't even know that Crowdfind existed here. It's basically like a virtual lost and found where shoes end up and keys. And I think they're talking about like a panda mask. And I mean, it's just a really funny, quirky, like well-reported story, which I've come to expect
maybe
from Borelli.
Change in 500 years would be like we don't do festivals because of that story.
I Grant Park still isn't usable because of Lollapalooza. I mean, it's like
he gets into that too. He talks about how it's like it. You know,
that's crazy.
I've always felt that they should build a permanent like Summerfest in Milwaukee, permanent grounds.
That's why they do that. That's why
where it's built for that, and so we can still have Grant
Park.
What
do you got for stories going to be remembered?
Well, I guess I went back to the soda tax because I think it's I think it seems like it's going to be repealed, and
this will be the week that did it,
and it might be the thing that undid Tony Preckwinkle's career as Cook County. Ooh. You know, I don't know. I mean, Richard Boykin looks like he's going to run against her, but maybe not. Now, maybe no one really runs against her, but she has been really damaged by this, and I don't think she saw it coming. And now when Mike Madigan is saying, hey, this is dangerous for my members here, so we got to get rid of this tax, that's a big sea change.
Mine is the last time Mike Glennon starts a football game
is this
Chicago
week.
Is this week. Sunday.
You're not going to remember that.
We hardly knew ye. The Mike Glennon era.
Great trivia. Who was Mike Glennon? Who was the Bears quarterback?
Mike Glennon was a Tampa Bay Buccaneers quarterback. Wait, he played for the Bears?
He's like the amalgamation of Shane Matthews and Craig Krenzel and every awful quarterback the Bears have ever had. I mean, it's like, God, what did we do to deserve this?
Barrett Schutz, political reporter and host over at Chicago Tonight, WTTW. Kevin Warwick, a former editor at Chicago Reader. Guys, can't thank you enough for coming in and reloading this week's news. Appreciate it.
Thank you for
thanks,
us.
Man.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest just played Lincoln Hall in Chicago. So give it up for the UK singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist Dan Kroll. That's the track Bad Boy, which is getting great support on iTunes, being added to the Breaking Alternative playlist, which is kind of like being in heavy rotation on WXRT back in the day.
Amazing.
Dan Kroll is getting the success he deserves. 27, you still 27?
I am,
should have checked that, right.
Yeah.
27-year-old singer-songwriter just put out a new album, Emerging Adulthood. It's the highly anticipated follow-up to his album, Sweet Disarray, which featured the track From Nowhere, which climbed the UK charts back in 2014. Dan Kroll is one of my favorite new artists, namely because he knows how to write a song that combines great melody, great music, and a little bit of message. Dan Kroll, welcome to the Download.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's just great to see you, man, and to have you here in Chicago. How often do you get through Chicago? I mean, you've been touring a lot, so...
Ooh, this is, I think, fifth time playing Chicago. We played our first ever show in Chicago. It was the first ever time we'd been in the States was Chicago. And we had... Actually, it was very memorable because we just played Schubert's Tavern. Mm-hmm. We'd come off stage, and whilst we were on stage, a snowstorm had hit, and it grounded all flights, and so we couldn't fly to Minneapolis. And because I didn't want to cancel my second ever show, which was in Minneapolis the next night, I decided to rent a van and drive through the snowstorm to Minneapolis through the night, and it was...
Did it work?
The craziest experience I've ever had.
That's terrifying. That's a terrifying drive
in
the snow.
It was, man.
Yeah.
It was. Only two of us could drive at that point, and so we just had to take, like, I don't know, it took us about 6-7 hours each, and it was horrible. Wow. We got in there in time at about 2 p.m. for a live radio session the next day, and we were just tired, but... Thankfully,
great
we haven't
memories.
Had to do that again. Yeah.
Well, you have such a great story when it comes to music because you kind of got into it at a relatively late age. Mm. You had sights on being a rugby star, doing something else with your life. Talk about that. Talk about beginning your musical career.
Yeah, it was late. You know, you meet a lot of people, or at least I meet a lot of musicians who are like, you know, I wrote my first song when I was 4 and I released an album when I was 8. And you're like, oh, great for you. I didn't. I was 17, 18 when I decided to pursue music. And that came after, my rugby career came to a very abrupt and painful end. With a broken leg, and because when I had this really bad break, I couldn't actually climb the stairs or any stairs, especially in my house, to get up to my bedroom or anything like that. And so we moved my bedroom down to like the kind of ground floor, the dining room, and in that room was like my sister's piano and my mum's record collection and stuff. And so I, you know, was suddenly kind of surrounded by a lot of music. There's a guitar in there as well, and just having the computer to just kind of browse as well. And so I just started kind of picking up instruments a bit, you know, reading my sister's kind of piano books. They were quite early on, and so I could pick it up and listening to all of these great records that my mum had in the house. And then it kind of dawned on me that these people were making a living. They were traveling and they were full-time musicians. And that never entered my head. I'd always listened to music as this kind of intangible thing, artists that were just kind of, I don't know, magical in a way. Like, I don't know how they did that. But it suddenly became a lot more accessible. And then on a bit of a whim, I decided to apply for a music university and then ended up in Liverpool, which was kind of like my second home anyway. And I'm still there.
Let's talk about Liverpool because we know, of course, in the States, we know Liverpool because of the Beatles. Mm. But talk about that music scene in that town because it does produce a lot of music. It produces a lot of bands. What is it about Liverpool and being there as a young, starting out musician that formed you?
Yeah, I think it's two things. I think it Well, not only these two things, but I think they play a big factor in it. And I think it's the price of being able to live in Liverpool is very cheap. And so you can, you know, you can work a job a couple of times a week, but then you've still got a lot of time to do music and or be creative, which, you know, if you move to somewhere like London, you will never get that chance. You're lucky to get one night to be able to be creative. And so a lot of people tend to stay up in Liverpool because they can just kind of live cheap. And the fact that the city is so small, you can walk from one side of the city to the other in half an hour. That's it.
But
and
it's
so
got
it's
such
so
a,
small and so it's
so
contained.
It's got such a rich history to it, but it's a city that has a great connection to rock and roll. Even in your case, I read that you lived above a bordello for a while.
Yeah,
I
mean,
there is a underground counterculture.
Massively, and it overlaps, and that's the main thing, and that's because of the size of the city. It overlaps. It's not like different boroughs of scenes and music. It is very much one small city with a lot of people doing a lot of different stuff, and you can't help but be influenced by those people. And so, like you say, you kind of have the, you know, classic songwriting of the Beatles. You've got like the kind of rock side of it, and like with the choral, and you've kind of got this, we've got a lot of kind of psychedelia there as well. And so all of that starts combining, and recently we've had a lot of pop and indie. We've got like Cirque Waves in there, and it's just a kind of this amalgamation of genres. You know, everyone's trying something else. Everyone's collaborating. So it's a very healthy
Sounds
place
like
to
your
be.
Music. Yeah.
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. Liverpool has massively shaped my music. It kind of birthed it, I guess, you know, in Stoke, where I was originally from. I really wasn't really doing anything. And the only people from Stoke are kind of Robbie Williams and Lemmy. But Lemmy didn't stay that long, you know. But So Liverpool, you know,
well,
it's fantastic.
Well, I read somewhere that you consider your music pop music, but you really are making a concentrated effort to approach it from a different angle, to try and do something different. And I think you can hear that in the music, and you can also hear it because of the crossing over in the genres and the music that you put together. How do you approach pop music, the music that you're creating?
In a way, I don't really know, because I just make the music, you know, I do, I've got to enjoy it, and so I'm just doing whatever I enjoy. But I guess there is this kind of subconscious feeling, like you say, that I've got to do it differently to what's already out there. And I think that's because I want it to be a bit more kind of honest and organic than what maybe is in the kind of top 10 of like the kind of charts, especially in the UK. You know, it is, there's about 9 ghostwriters in a room, and it's all kind of electronically done. There's not real instruments on there even. And so for me, I want to, you know, it is my goal to compete with these artists. I want to be a commercial pop artist. But at the same time, I want to come at it from a slightly alternative angle and maybe give listeners something a little bit different to what is being offered in those kind of top 10s, top 20s. And I think, yeah, that comes from the kind of influences of like those kind of alternative.
You know, it's interesting because in the U.S., the top 10s, the top 20s, I mean, it's the same kind of experience. Mm. You have bands that are much more electronic now that are taking over at the pop music that gets played on the radio here. Mm. In the U.K., when you say there's 9 or 10 ghostwriters, I mean, is there a certain style of music that's coming out of London right now that's just dominating
everything? Yeah, well, this is the thing, this is why I love being over in America, because the kind of whole radio system is so open. It's brilliant. And so I guess when I say top 10s, top 20s, actually you've got about a million top 10s, top 20s of different genres and stuff like that. Whereas in the UK, we have the BBC and we have Radio 1 and Radio 2 and Radio 3. Right. And it kind of, that's it in a way. There's a couple more. But so we kind of share this top 10, top 20. And so there's all kinds in there, in those charts. And I guess it's just, you know, it's just pop. There's so much pop in there. And occasionally you might get like a kind of indie band in there or someone doing something. But generally it is a kind of conveyor belt feel.
From my point of view, and this obviously
is personal to me, I do feel like it is that kind of conveyor belt of grabbing a young artist, kind of putting them in a studio with a bunch of writers, you know, who are kind of only really there just to grab a few kind of royalties here and there. And everyone's just kind of writing for that big hit, and that's cool. But then, you know, it's sad that the album dies out because of that kind of thing.
It's interesting, too, for the limited time that I've been overseas and in London or Scotland or anywhere in the area, the music that will be a top 10 or a pop music, it's not necessarily a crossover song from an artist that Americans would even know. It's these artists that will do these really bubblegum type songs that are played in the clubs and
massively,
whatever, that you never hear about in the States. It's not your Ellie Goulding's or your blanking on the kid's name who does The Shape of You. Ed Sheeran. Sorry.
No.
I just turned into a dad real quick right there. I'm so sorry. But it feels like it's a there is almost this category that that American audiences never get.
Yeah, I guess it's strange. I don't know what it is. You know, there are artists that are doing it. They're writing their songs and stuff like that, and they occasionally break through. But it's tough. You know, we have these kinds of introducing radio stations and stuff like that, but the percentage of what really gets through that is kind of organic music, and you know, people who are really putting in the effort, you know, they're paying for studios with real instruments in, which costs way more than just a kind of guy in his room with beats on a laptop and stuff, you know, people who are really making the effort. And so I'm persistent to make that effort and, you know, try and at least claw my way in there, you know, even if it's right at the back. You know, I just want to get in there, because someone might just hear it and be introduced to something new from me, you know.
Yeah.
Not necessarily
Liverpool-based pop singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist Dan Kroll in studio tonight. He was just in Chicago at Lincoln Hall, and he, of course, just put out a new album called Emerging Adulthood, which is getting great reviews. It's also the track Bad Boy is on iTunes. It's in playlists. It's in rotations. This was he recorded with Ben Allen in Atlanta, who's done Animal Collective, Deer Hunter, CeeLo Green at one point, Matt and Kim.
Yeah.
But you made the choice to get out of Liverpool and to do this album in the States, in Atlanta, with an indie rock producer as opposed to a pop producer. Why'd you make that choice?
Well, I think Ben actually offered both things. On one side, you have got the kind of real kind of indie left field kind of acts like Animal Collective and Deer Hunter, who I love. And I wanted that kind of rawness and that kind of drive from those guys, you know, that Ben brought. But then on the other hand, he's worked with like CeeLo Green, and I think he did some stuff with like A. Marie. And it's like suddenly he's got this, you know, he himself has got this poppy side and slight R&B kind of side to him. That's how he started. He was kind of, I think he was, his first intern job was in New York, and he's doing a lot of hip hop and R&B stuff. And so for me, that was like the kind of golden ratio, because that's what I want. You know, I want that kind of, I love pop. You know, I do I do enjoy kind of sugar-coated pop from time to time. And so I want a bit of that. You know, I want that foot in the commercial sector, I guess. And then on the other side, I want that kind of rawness and realness of bands like Deer Hunter and Animal Collective. Yeah. So for me, Ben was perfect. And it was just great that I got to kind of go to Atlanta to work with him.
When you get the chance to work with someone like Ben, talk about that relationship, because you get in there, there's producer, it's not necessarily the artist. In your case, you know, you're not just coming and saying, these are the tracks and this is how I want it to sound, press record. He plays a role in shaping what you're doing. Talk about that from the artist standpoint. How is that working with a producer pushing you?
Ben was really funny. Ben's a real kind of, he was almost quite British in the kind of dry humor, you know, part of it. And so we really got on. And, you know, we chatted, we Skyped before I even got to Atlanta. And so, you know, I kind of got to know him a little bit there. And so it was, you know, it was pretty smooth to just kind of go into the studio. But it's a different dynamic when you are doing it all yourself, like I was. You know, I'm not going in there with, you know, four other band members or anything like that. It is just me. And it is me all day, every day for 2 months, you know. And so you kind of got to really understand each other and know how to work with each other and alongside each other. And I think Ben did that perfectly. I think he really sussed on to the fact that I came from a sporting background, and he instantly knew how driven and how competitive I was. And he would use that against me in such a brilliant way that, like, he would just make up people. So I was, you know, I was playing all of the instruments on this album. And so, you know, if I was underperforming on one of these instruments, because I am not the best at each instrument, you know, I know bits and bobs of each one, and I drive and I compete with myself to understand these instruments better and get something good out of them. And Ben was brilliant, you know, especially sometimes when I was playing drums, if I was kind of underperforming, he'd just kind of come on the talkback system and he'd just be like, so I've got this friend, Derek. He's a roofer down the road. And I tell you what, he plays drums. He's really good. I reckon if I call him now, he can come down to the studio in about 10 minutes and he can knock this out of the park and we can go for tacos. And I'd be like, no, don't call him. Don't call him. And he'd keep getting me with it. You know, he'd keep being like, oh, I've got this friend. Yeah, Stacey. She's a great backing vocalist. She could hit those high notes. Yeah, yeah, she could get that. And I was like, no, don't call her. I can get this. And so he'd be really good. You know, it's you know, you need that kind of understanding of how people work, you know.
emerging adulthood, and I mentioned this in the intro, but the idea that there is a little bit of a message. You are kind of going after a theme record when it comes to issues like self-confidence, mental health. You can feel like this idea of exploring some of the stereotypes of youth and this idea. Where does that come from? Where's the idea of really taking those issues of self-confidence, belief, mental health, those kind of things, and putting it to music?
For me, it all came from after the first album. I ended up getting dropped by my record label. I was with a big major label. I got dropped, and then I was left by my management as a kind of knock-on effect from that. And so after that first album, which I personally felt did so well.
It had a great, single, too.
So I didn't have any expectations because I'd entered this kind of game so late. And so my expectations were just, like, getting it pressed. You know, that for me was mind-blowing to have an album pressed. And you know, the album charted, I think, at like 18 in the UK in the album charts, which for me was just mind-blowing. And obviously they wanted the kind of top 10. And so, you know, I was let go. And so for someone so new to this whole industry to be kind of suddenly signed and then suddenly dropped, it was really tough. And it hit a really tough 2 years of, you know, really lacking confidence and feeling very low and struggling with the kind of anxiety and trust issues. And so it really hit me all at once in those kind of 2 years after releasing that first album. And so, you know, once I decided that I actually wanted to do a second album, you know, I decided to write it in a very tight frame period so that it was all very fresh and it was all very cohesive and, you know, it kind of covered similar topics because that was what I was going through in that time period. And so, yeah, and I was just reading this book that really kind of helped me get through it, and it was great. And then, yeah, I guess it just kind of went from there.
Dan, we have a lot of musicians on the show, but I have to say that the album is wonderful. I think
it's
one of the best of the year. Emerging Adulthood is the name of the album. Dan Kroll is the artist, the Liverpool-based singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist. Was just in town at Lincoln Hall, but you can hear the song Bad Boy, which is on heavy rotation right now on iTunes, in the Breaking Alternative playlist. Which, again, I make the joke. It's like, for my generation, that's like getting played on Q101 in Chicago. You know, it's like just over and over and over. So, Dan, congratulations on your early success, and we look forward to more music.
Thanks so much.